So welcome to this sixth episode of a coffee room chat in ENT, a collaboration between the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh and ENT UK. So today's podcast comes from the Head and Neck Society, and we're joined by Sanjay Sood, who's the current president of the society and is a consultant ENT surgeon in Bradford. And he'll be speaking with Stuart Winter, who's a member of council and also an ENT surgeon in Oxford. So they'll be discussing recurrent pleomorphic adenoma, what the principles are of surgery around this, dealing with intraoperative spillage, how to investigate these patients, and importantly, how to counsel patients as to the risk and the techniques that you might use during surgery.
Hey. Hi, Stuart. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Good, good. What have you got on today? Anything exciting?
Well, I've got an interesting case. I've got a lady who is in her 30s, and about 7 years ago, she had a parotidectomy in a European country. She's been over here for a few years working. And she now presents with a 2-centimeter lump within the parotid itself.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. Quite a challenge, that.
So, yeah, I mean, pick your brains, actually, as you're the older, more senior surgeon here. What do you do when you're first doing a parotid to minimize recurrence?
Yeah, well, that's the key to it, isn't it? I think your first shot is your most important shot at this. And even I think if you're very experienced, even if you're doing it as well as you can, it's inevitable. If you do enough of these, you will get a recurrence. But I think there's two options, isn't there? One is to take a really large margin around the primary tumor. But then that, of course, means you're taking a lot more of the gland away, increases risk of frays, probably increases risk to the facial nerve a bit, and other complications like bleeding. So I think we're heading more currently towards taking away the tumor with a minimal amount of tissue around it. But with that, you've got to be really careful and understand the principles. And I think one of the principles, I think, you know, are the little pseudopodia, the fact that the capsule's not always complete. So I think the key is to go really carefully, look at the MRI imaging, look at the ultrasound, and know where the tumor is, its relation to surrounding structures, if you like. And, you know, just take care not to spill it. I sometimes do extracapsular dissection. I don't know if you've had any experience with that. Do you do that?
Yeah, I've started doing some of them because I think there is a potential advantage to that. But I would agree. I think you've actually got to be more careful when you're doing that because you're right on the capsule at that stage.
Yes, but I find even doing it the traditional way, sometimes the tumor is just right on the facial nerve. In fact, quite often it is. So you end up peeling the nerve off the tumor. And in fact, you're almost doing a little bit of an extra capsular dissection in certain parts. But I think as long as you understand that it's an incomplete capsule and you're careful, that's all you can do. The problem is, and I'm not sure if it's happened to you, but it has happened to me over the years, as I have had cases where the operating surgeon that I've been assisting or supervising has caused a spillage. And that's always a bit of a hairy moment, if you like. It's not a pleasant scenario. But what do you do if you do get a spillage? What's your experience with it?
Well, I'd agree. I think it's it's much more difficult. It depends on which stage of the operation it's at. If you're about to have, you know, remove the tumor, but I would agree most of these are sat on the nerve. And the other time I find them challenging is when they're really up against the mastoid. So they tend to take a sort of out. They're very bosselated at that point and you're peeling them off the bone.
Yes. And quite easy to use manipulation and just cause a little bit of, it's not that difficult to spill it if you're not careful, actually.
Absolutely. I think the first thing to do is to suck away sort of the caseating cheesy material so that you remove all of that. Make sure you know which your clean instruments are. And then I will often try to close that rupture if you can, but it's harder than it seems because the capsule, as you say, doesn't really hold anything.
No, I agree. I'll do the same. I'll try to get a fine Vicryl, try to close it carefully, and then for the rest of the procedure, be really careful about how I'm going to manipulate the tissue around that area, because it's just going to burst open again. But what do you think about washout? Because that's controversial. Some people feel it just, you end up spreading the little cells everywhere. Others feel it's certainly something useful to do. What's your view?
I mean, I tend not to wash out. I've always, so for cancer surgery, I do use irrigation to wash out, but I think that's a slightly different situation. And I've always tried to avoid it on the basis that, you know, you're potentially spreading little cells around. Almost certainly you're not going to use adjuvant therapy after a parotidectomy, whereas you are in a malignant situation. So I tend not to. I might sometimes put a little clip near the area just in case there's questions about radiological recurrence afterwards. But but I've always avoided washing out for that reason. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I do tend to wash out, maybe just the way I've been trained. But there was a evidence-based meeting on salivary tumours some time ago in Manchester. And the audience had Max Fax surgeons and ENT surgeons in as well. And about 60 or 70%, the majority decided they would wash out, but a good proportion didn't. So it's clearly not clear what's best to do. And there's certainly no evidence for it. There's nothing in the literature either way. So back to your case there, I think that's quite a challenging case because I'm presuming you've not really managed to look at the old notes and what exactly was done in the European country.
No, I think that's often the challenge, because if it's from my institution, then you've got a pretty good idea of what technique they used. I've got some translated histology which says this was a pleomorphic adenoma.
Oh, that's good to know.
But we don't quite know who looked at that, and obviously it was a few years ago. She's got a traditional scar, which is helpful to look at, and her facial nerve function is normal at the moment, although she did have what sounds like a transient, reasonably dense facial nerve palsy for about a month after her last surgery, and that's recovered back to normal, but she gives a pretty good description about that.
So I'm presuming therefore they've definitely explored and found the nerve if she's had that neuropraxia.
I think that, well, I assume so, yes, based on the shape of the scar and her description of her recovery afterwards.
Yeah, because I've had some cases which have been done at other centres by other specialties where there's just a neck incision, not the classic parotid incision. And in a way, when I go back into that neck, I'm a little bit relieved because I know they've not explored the facial nerve. So it's much easier to find. You're going to have your hands full today trying to find that nerve, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with that sort of incision and that history, I'm already expecting that we will have to go and find the nerve and trace it out to preserve it and sort of remove this tumour.
And I presume that you MRI all these patients just to see if there's multiple nodules or a single nodule.
Well, I was going to ask, what's your preferred investigation? Yes, I do use MRI. I think I think it's almost essential, actually, to look for the single versus the multiple nodule.
Yeah, I think so. I think in primary tumours, some people will say an ultrasound's enough, although I tend to MRI those patients as well. But for recurrence, I think an MRI is mandatory because you need to know. I've certainly had patients where they've had nodules spill all around the neck. I've had to almost do a bit of a neck dissection to clear all the nodules out. And you can't feel them clinically. So I think an MRI is important. Yeah, and in fact, the majority are actually multi-nodular. It's less common just to have a single foci, if you like, of recurrence.
Yeah, I'd agree with that as well. Often there's small, once you know you've got one, you look carefully and you can see small little dots elsewhere.
So have you put this case through the MDT at this stage, or do you wait till after you've done it?
Well, I'm going to get an FNA first of all, actually, and I'm just waiting for that to come back. But we will put her through the MDT. Yes, put all of these through our MDT, actually.
Yes.
Do you FNA them all?
I FNA them all, ultrasound guided usually. And especially if I haven't had previous histology. But also, you know, it could be, if it's a single foci, it could be a recurrent pleomorphic X carcinoma. You know, it could be one of those. So you can't be sure it's the same histology. I think, yeah, therefore, you should do an FNA. So I think, for me personally, ultrasound-guided FNA and MRI is mandatory.
I'd agree, actually. I think you can't assume it's the same pathology. There is a small malignant risk.
Yes.
Out of interest, because often patients do ask what that risk is of malignancy. What do you tell them?
It just was, and some series say it's as high as 15%. Now, we know in recurrence, the risk of malignancy is higher than it is in the primary tumor. So I tend to just use a ballpark figure around 10% with them. Do you think that's reasonable?
Yeah, I'd probably say about 5 to 10%, but it reflects the poor knowledge we've got of these. And I think it's indicative of the sort of risk that that is there.
Yeah, and are you going to, when you do go to surgery on this lady, I presume you'll use a facial nerve monitor, will you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I use a facial nerve monitor for all of my parotids.
Same here.
I think for a recurrence, it's absolutely essential as well, actually.
Yeah, so some specialties only use it for the recurrence, but what's interesting is that then I think, you know, the monitor goes off all the time sometimes. So if you're not using it regularly, you don't really get a grip on when it's being useful to you, whether it's misfiring, if you like. So I think your policy of using it for every prot is very sensible. I certainly do the same.
I struggle to, you know, I mean, if I do use it, and I think if it's available in your hospital, I struggle to see why, you know, it's there, you know, it's freely available, why you wouldn't use it for all parotids. You know, as you say, you're often peeling the nerve off, and actually sometimes with extracapsular dissection, you know that you're going to be pushing the nerve to the sides. You've got to look for that as well. So I find it helpful, and particularly for training as well. I find it reassuring for me as
yes.
well.
Yeah. So in terms of the facial nerve, what risks would you quote?
Well, I think that's always, you know, I mean, I tend to say that if this was for a primary, I would say that there was a risk of temporary weakness of up to 20-25% that will recover.
Yep.
And a 1-2% risk of permanent damage. For the recurrent, it's harder to give an absolute number. The fact that this patient had a neuropraxia after her last operation, I personally think puts her at a higher risk of having one on this operation.
Yes, I agree.
And I would say that all the risk of a permanent damage of one or of the branches is much higher than 1% in a revision case, even using nerve monitors, loops and microscopes if needed.
Yeah, so I actually go quite high because I just want to emphasize to the patient that there is a real risk here. So I would say 30 to 40% neuropraxia and 5 to 10% permanent. And it's probably a little bit lower than that, but actually it does happen much more frequently in these cases, even if you're really careful. Because I think, you know, you'll end up having to do a retrograde dissection to find the facial nerve. And then when you get to the main branch in these cases, it's so much scar tissue, it's actually really quite difficult.
So what's always tricky is if the patient, you know, you put them through the MDT.
Yes.
What do you do when the patient says, I'm not sure, you know, what's the downside of leaving this lump? How do you deal with that?
Well, I just tell them that there's a risk of it becoming malignant, that it's likely to grow bigger. And therefore, if they elect to have surgery later, we know that the bigger the tumor, the greater the risk of the facial nerve. So the risk to facial nerve goes up. But it's perfectly reasonable for them to be nervous and to not rush into it. And I do, in some cases, offer an annual MRI to monitor it. And I think if you wait a year and repeat the MRI, I don't think that's particularly dangerous. I think that's reasonable practice. But I found in most cases that the patients that are nervous initially, when they come back after a year, they almost always elect to have surgery because they've been thinking about it. They're worried about it. They keep feeling the lump in their neck. And they come back and they usually decide to have it out. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I totally agree. I, I think that's the difference between when you're a consultant and you've got the ability to see them in a year's time,
yes,
versus a one-off appointment. Because I think the risks are greater than primary surgery. It's more complicated. And actually having a year for them to think about it, or a serial scan that shows that it's growing a millimeter or two, often, you know, nudges them in the direction,
yes,
that they want to go. Yeah, and I think for this patient who's only in her 30s, we're almost certainly going to operate at some stage.
Yes.
If she was in her 70s or 80s and maybe not quite so fit, I'd be very comfortable with just keeping an eye on it.
Yes, yeah. And then I suppose you can always think about radiotherapy at that age group as well. Because although radiotherapy doesn't get rid of it, there is evidence that it stops it growing and reduces the rate of recurrence and malignant transformation.
Yeah, I agree. What's your MDT's take on radiotherapy, either without surgery or after surgery? Do you offer it?
So we still class this as a benign disease, and the oncologists are very reluctant to offer it in young people. But, you know, if it's someone who's 70 or 80, then yes, maybe. But someone in their 30s, we have a frank discussion with the patient. Most of my patients have elected against radiotherapy. We watch them for life. You know, I book them to my clinic and keep an eye on them for life, because you can have very late recurrences with these patients, as you know. But with radiotherapy, we offer it to them. We discuss it with them. But I would say the way we present it, we're fairly clear on the risks. And most patients, and I think quite sensibly, in my opinion, elect not to have it if they're in their 30s. What about your MDT?
So it's discussed with all patients. And actually, when I first started as a consultant about 10 years ago, we probably were a bit keener to offer it. And because of the risks of irradiating young people, I'd agree. We've moved, you know, in general, most people don't go for it, particularly if they're younger people. I think if, yes, they're coming back for a second or third operation, I think that's when it can become, a more pervasive or persuasive argument, because, people don't like having multiple operations, and
no,
the risks increase significantly every time you have to do anything.
And the risk of malignant transformation as well. We know that the more recurrences you have, the higher the risk of malignant transformation. So for both those reasons, I think that's a different scenario. So I think in our MDT, if it's a recurrence, we offer them radiotherapy in a slightly more positive way, if you like, and encourage them to take that offer up.
Yeah, I think we're very much the same, actually. And, particularly in young people, our oncologists are very wary about offering radiotherapy. So you follow them up for life. How do you scan them regularly, or do you just see them clinically?
I see them clinically. And sometimes I'll do a scan at year two. There's no evidence for that. It's just something I do. I don't think I've picked anything up, so it's not something. But I just like to, and I think they feel reassured by that as well, particularly if they've got multiple nodules. I think if it's a solitary and I'm clear that I've taken it out and the histology shows it's out, then I won't scan them. And for those patients, I may only follow them for 5 years. But for the multiple nodules, you know, the chances are that you probably haven't got it all out with surgery. You probably missed a few small ones if you're not careful. And on those patients, I'll sometimes do an MR at year two just to see if there's any other nodules lighting up on it.
Do you treat multiple nodules any differently to a single nodule?
Just a wider excision. So, you know, with a single nodule, I may still go in and do, if you like, a partial prostatectomy. Multiple nodules, I'll take it all out. And I may also take out some of the sort of fatty tissue, if you like, around the sternum. I stood up at level two area just to clear it all out. What about you?
Pretty similar, actually. If it's a single nodule, I think they're often a little bit easier to tackle, whereas multiple nodules, as you say, the hardest ones are when you can't feel them, but you know they're there because you've seen, yes, the scan. But as soon as you've lifted the skin flap, it's quite hard. And I'll sometimes get the ultrasound scanner out with a sterile cover.
Yes.
Just to sort of, you know, and it's important to scan them yourself beforehand so you know what you're looking for, and then you can just find them, because some of them can be terribly difficult to feel once you
lift the skin up. They're just little tiny things that you can't see, and sometimes in those cases you just got to then rely on the scan and reset that area that's been lit up on the scan, basically, haven't you?
Yeah, I agree. Almost doing.
But I think the main thing is really, I think the primary parotid surgery is really important. It's done carefully. That's the crux of it.
I agree. Well, that's been really helpful. Thanks for that.
Good to speak to you. Take care now.
So thank you very much to Sanjay Sood and to Stuart Winter for allowing us to listen into the discussion. I think it's clear that recurrent pleomorphic adenoma can be a very challenging disease to manage and really needs to be looked after by surgeons who have experience of these cases. So next week, we turn to rhinology, and please, I hope that you will join us to listen to Shaz Ahmed, who's an ENT surgeon from Birmingham, and Omar Pathmanabhan, who's a neurosurgeon from Manchester. And they'll be discussing how to manage patients with spontaneous CSF leaks.